So this evening's topic for the talk is ghosts, devils, angels, and gods. Are they real? Can they affect or control us? So this is the this evening's talk. Now, before I get on to this topic and talk about it, I wanted to briefly start. Is that somebody's mobile calling there? Thank you very much for leaving your mobile on, because that's a reminder of impermanence and uncertainty. So before starting this talk, I wanted to talk briefly about the earthquake and tsunami in Japan, because what happens, of course, when you have these very terrible disasters and so many lives are destroyed and so many people hurt and suffer because of it, and sometimes people say it was because of their karma. And this has got so bad, I have to say, this misunderstanding of the teaching of karma has got so bad with the latest one. Within a few days of the earthquake, and you can have a look at it online, within a few days there was a website called Karma Japan. I think it's called karmajapan.com or something like that. And it's full of people who are saying, yeah, that'll teach you for Pearl Harbor. Seriously. Terrible, yeah? Terrible, terrible thing. This is your karma for Pearl Harbor, or whatever. Such a terrible thing. So this has got nothing to do with karma, and nothing to do with what the teaching of karma is about. And I've been saying this for many years, and I know many other teachers have as well, but sometimes people get confused because they hear different things from different people, and sometimes teachers will come along and say, oh, this is because of karma, and then somebody will come along and say it's not, and so people get confused. They don't know what to believe. So I say throw all those opinions out. Only one opinion really matters, and that's the big guy. Okay, so here we're going to hear from what the Buddha himself said. So the Buddha talked about the 8 causes of earthquakes, all right, in the Digha Nikaya. Okay, this is in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and also found in the Anguttara Nikaya. The 8 causes of earthquakes. That's all right. I'm fine. Yeah. So what happened when the Buddha announced that he was going to pass away? He renounced his life faculty, and then there was a great earthquake as a result of that, and Ananda went to him and asked him, what is the cause for the earthquake? And the Buddha said there are 8 reasons, and I'll just read the reasons briefly for you. First one, it says this great earth is established on water, the water established on the air on space, and when a mighty wind blows, this stirs up the water, and through the stirring up of the water, the earth quakes. That's the first reason. I'll come back to that one in a minute. Second place, there is an ascetic or Brahman. That means that there's someone with highly developed meditation or spiritual powers has developed the psychic powers, or a mighty and powerful deva. Okay, so it's either a meditator or perhaps some kind of deva, which comes back to the theme of the talk, whose earth consciousness is weakly developed and whose water consciousness is immeasurable, and he makes the earth shudder and shake and violently quake. So this comes back to this idea from meditation circles, that when you're developing these various psychic powers, that the different kinds of psychic powers which manifest in the physical realm are caused by, are brought about by a meditator who like tunes into one or other of the different elements, and by meditating on that element, their mind can kind of tune into that frequency and they can affect that. So by affecting the balance between earth and water, this is how the earthquake is caused. So that's the second reason. Third reason, when the Bodhisattva descends from the Tusita heaven, mindfully and clearly aware, into his mother's womb. Fourth one, when the Bodhisattva emerges from his mother's womb. Fifth one, when the Tathagata attains the enlightenment. Fifth one, that was the fifth one. When the sixth reason, when the Buddha sets in motion the wheel of Dhamma. That's the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. The sixth one, that's the sixth reason. The seventh reason, when the Buddha renounces the, he decides that he will give up his future life. So he a few months before he dies, he makes the determination that he'll pass away in shortly. Then the last one is when the Buddha actually passes away. This is the eighth reason. So the last six reasons are solely to do with the Buddha and his appearance. Okay, so they're spiritual ones, and obviously, well, there's no Buddhas around these days, so they're not going to happen these days. The second reason is to do with psychic powers. Yeah, so someone using their psychic powers. And the first one is the natural causes. So I think it's probably very likely that most of the earthquakes we're experiencing today are because of the natural causes. None of them have anything to do with karma. Right? You want me to go through the eight? Do you think you missed any? None of them say because anybody did karma or because a nation did karma or anything like that. Nothing to do with karma. So the first one, the natural causes, here it's talking about this idea that the earth rests on water. And this is the ancient Indian cosmology. Yeah, they believe the earth rests on water and the water on the air and the air on space. And then when the air moves and shakes, then it causes the ripples in the water. And then that's what causes an earthquake. Now, of course, today, our understanding of geology and cosmology is very different. But it's still not that different, actually, is it? Because we also understand that underneath the crust on the Earth's surface, there's also liquid underneath, and the molten rock and so on. And when that's disturbed and when the pressures become too great, this is what causes the earthquakes. Yeah. So even though in detail it's not quite the same as what's taught in the sutta there, but it's not too dissimilar given the different assumptions behind it. So this is an explanation purely in terms of the forces of nature, okay? And so sometimes that's all it is. Sometimes the earthquakes, because the forces of nature, the shifts in the tectonic plates and these kinds of things are happening. If that's not the case, okay? Now, if we were to have an earthquake, for example, in Australia, where it's very stable geologically. Occasionally we have small earthquakes in Australia, but generally it's very stable. And if we were to have an earthquake there, and the geologists were to look at it and to think, we can't explain this, yeah? There's no geological reason for this earthquake, then we might suspect it's cause number two, yeah? Maybe some meditator has got angry in their meditation or something like that, and they've caused it, so that might look for that reason. But when we can explain things according to everyday normal natural processes, then there's no need to be looking for other kinds of explanation. So I especially wanted to read that for you this evening, and to just to show that this idea that these kinds of natural disasters are caused by karma is not the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha is very clear on this and very explicit. He explicitly said that it's not the case that everything is caused by karma. Only some things are caused by karma. Yeah, and when people are saying these kinds of things, then this is certainly a misrepresentation of what the law of karma is according to how the Buddha taught it. Okay. Any questions on that point before I go on? All right. Okay. So now I have to come to the main topic of the talk, is about different kinds of beings in different realms and so on. Are they real? How do they affect us and so on? And of course we have like a coming together of two different points of view, don't we? That from a traditional Buddhist point of view, it's automatically assumed that devas and yakas and pretas, and it's got a very rich cosmology, yeah? Much of which is, of course, shared in common with Hindu and Indian cosmology. some of which is local. In the different local traditions, they have their own kinds of beings. In Thailand, they have the pi. It's a kind of ghost. Or in Burma, they have the nuts. And in Chinese cultures, of course, they have many different kinds of ghosts and so on. So in traditional Buddhist cultures, it's taken for granted that these things exist, that they're real, and also that they influence people. Yeah? So when, for example, I was in Thailand, I stayed for a while in a monastery called Phujomgom, which is on the very, very easternmost tip of Thailand, in a very remote region, overlooking the Mekong River and overlooking Laos. And that part of Thailand is very poor, very backwards, and very simple, and of course a great place for a forest monastery. So anyway, there we are meditating. And one day we heard this announcement over the village loudspeaker system. Okay, so they make these announcements, and they're making these announcements, and because it's distant and it's spoken in the local dialect, we couldn't really make it out what they were saying, so we asked people to tell us what was going on. And they told us this story, that a few days prior to that, and also what happened was that people had stopped coming to the monastery. Okay, so some of the people who would normally come to bring dana and so on weren't showing up. And some people still came, but some people didn't. So we asked what was happening, and they told us that a few days earlier, this woman had been possessed by some kind of devil or demon, and this demon made her do many, you know, really, really crazy things. Eventually, the demon took this woman up to the top of a cliff where we were. We were on cliffs overlooking the Mekong, and it threw her off. It made her jump off the cliff to try to kill herself. This was how badly she was demented. But she didn't die. She landed at the bottom of the cliff, very badly injured, and still not dead. So the demon then dragged her, the demon that had possessed her, dragged her back up to the top of the cliff and made her jump off again, which she did, and she died the second time. And then the demon entered another woman in the village, yeah? And this woman was kind of screaming and demanding alcohol, yeah, wanted to get drunk, and also demanded a pig. He told the villagers, "Get me a pig and sacrifice a pig for me." Yeah, and that was what the announcement was on the village loudspeaker. They were calling for donations so the village could put together and buy a pig that they could sacrifice to appease this demon and make it go away. Yeah. So that was quite a shocking story for us to hear, yeah? And it's the reason why they weren't coming to the monastery was that they were too scared. They thought there's this evil demon around, so that they're too scared because they had to walk through a bit of forest to get to the monastery. They didn't want to. So these things taken quite for granted in traditional Buddhist cultures. And, you know, you have to admit that you know, it's a bit hard to explain some of these things coming from a Western model. Like, you might think, okay, one person goes crazy, but then why, after she died, did another person in the village have the same reaction? Yeah, it's a bit hard to explain. Anyway, so that's from a traditional point of view. Of course, from a Western point of view, a secular point of view, the traditionally, of course, in the West, would have looked on these things in very much the same way. Yeah. So if somebody had possession experience or saw a ghost or something like that, it would be seen as being some kind of entity, in very much the same way. But with the from the 19th century and the 20th century onwards, there was a very strong development of a secular tendency within Western culture, and what the psychologists started to investigate from the time of Freud and others, and they started to say that many of these kinds of phenomena, which have previously been explained as possession or some influence of some external entity, can actually be explained in terms of a person's own internal psychological dynamics. Yeah, the basic idea is that what we tend to do is project, yeah? That we take parts of ourselves and we assume that parts of ourselves exist independently of us, yeah? And so this is a psychological dynamic. And the psychologists would then tend to explain away all of these things. So this is the tendency in modern psychology, is to say that possession and ghost experiences and so on are merely projections, internal projections of the person. And of course, I think it's obvious that in many cases that's quite correct, right? In many cases, that's obviously true, but that doesn't mean it's the case all the time. So that kind of point of view has, in recent years, been introduced into Buddhism, and we have the emergence of a kind of secular Buddhism. And the most well-known proponent of that is a fellow called Stephen Batchelor. I don't know, has anyone here heard of Stephen Batchelor? Yeah. So he's an author and an ex-monk, and he tries to present a form of Buddhism which he claims is closer to the spirit of the original Buddha, and he bases a lot of his things on the Pali Canon. And one of his agendas is to try to marginalize all of these phenomena like rebirth and the existence of other realms and beings and these kinds of things. And he wants to say that these things are merely cultural products. They are merely aspects of the belief in the time of the Buddha, which became incorporated into the Buddha's teachings. Yeah? And so there's that kind of tendency which you find. And obviously, in a sense, that way of approaching Buddhism is, well, certainly has its place, because, you know, there are many people today who are very skeptical about these things, and yet who still can learn a lot and benefit a lot about Buddhism. And so there's some people who feel, look, I'd like to, you know, come and do meditation, I'd like to practice mindfulness and so on, but I'm really not sure about, you know, when Buddhists go on about this rebirth thing and stuff like that. So it's very understandable that we should present Buddhism in a way that's appealing for people who are like that. But personally, I think that Stephen Batchelor and his approach goes too far. And to try to say that all of these things are just the product of an Indian culture is, I think, a bit of an insult to the Buddha and a bit of an insult to the Buddhist traditions. The Buddha was very discerning. Yeah, the Buddha was very able to listen to all the things that were going around him and to accept what he wanted to accept and to reject what he wanted to reject. And we find these things constantly happening in the suttas, in the Pali Canon. And many places the Buddha is in dialogue with philosophers and ascetics and meditators from different traditions, and he will always adopt that questioning, inquiring attitude. Yeah? He never just accepts things without thought or without reflection. Some things he'll say, yes, that's true, that's right, and he'll accept them. Other things he'll reject. Yeah? This is the Buddha's way. So I think just to argue that something which is such a major part of the teaching was just a cultural influence, I don't think is a really tenable argument. So in any case, here we have these two camps or two perspectives, one of which the traditional approach, which accepts that these things all exist without too much question or consideration, and then a kind of a modern secular approach that wants to dismiss them all, and again without too much reflection. So I think it's an important topic for us to consider and to see what we can learn from these different approaches. Now, there's a few basics that we need to sort out before we can start to look at these things more clearly. One thing is that, according to the Buddha, none of these kinds of beings, all right, in the different realms, are inherently very different from you and I. All right? This is the most important thing. That all the beings in the world, wherever they are, whatever realm they're in, they're basically pretty much the same. Okay? Okay, there are differences, but they're still five khandhas, yeah? form, feeling, perception, volition, consciousness, the five aggregates, or the six senses. They're pretty much all the beings have those things. And the way that beings' minds work in the different realms, greed, hatred, and delusion, yeah, the underlying motivations for action, these things are also pretty much similar in the different realms. So even though, like in the human realm, we see, you know, poor people, rich people, old people, young people, different races, different cultures, different levels of intelligence, different abilities, sick people, well people, all of those differences, but we recognize that people are underneath are pretty much the same, yeah, as human beings. We can understand each other. And so according to Buddhism, that all these different realms are pretty much the same. And that beings move between these realms. So it's not like you're created as a god or an angel or a devil or something like that, and that's who you are forever. But these are stations of life during the course of samsara that we get reborn into for a period of time because of some karma, and then we pass away and get reborn somewhere else. Okay? So these are important principles. And this also is where the notion of karma comes in. Now, I said at the start of the talk that karma doesn't determine everything. All right, we can't use it as a catch-all explanation for everything that happens. But karma does cause some things, and according to the Buddha, the most important thing that karma does determine is where you get reborn. Okay, that's not all that it determines, but it's the most important thing. Where is it that you get reborn? Okay, so when we die, there's a force in our mind, there's an energy, and that energy is karma. And that energy directs us to one place or another. So it may be to the human realm, maybe to one of the animal realms, maybe to one of the heaven realms or one of the lower realms. And once we've made that choice, and once we've gone into that particular realm, then that will more or less affect the kinds of things that can happen to you. It doesn't fix them, but it more or less shapes our experiences in our life. I'll give you an example from my experience. Is my grandfather was born in Yorkshire, in England. It's a very poor working class area, and when he was young, he was about 13, he used to work on the docks. He went to work on the docks where he would he told it to me one day, and they used to have these big drums on the docks, and they would lay the ship's cable in the drums. And because he was small, he would get inside the cable and inside the drum and crawl around, laying these ship's cables, just crawling around in circles all day. That's what he would do: was crawl around in a circle inside this drum. Yeah. So while he was doing that, he thought, well, I've got to get out of here, right? So he saved up a bit of money, as much money as he could, and as soon as he could, he decided to emigrate. And he wanted to go to Canada. So he went there and said, I want to emigrate to Canada. But they didn't have any places. The boat was full. Yeah? So he said, well, where can I go? And they said, well, there's a ship going to this place in Australia called Perth. And you can go there if you want. So he said, okay, I'll take it. So that's how he ended up in Perth. And that's how he met my grandmother, and that's how they had my mother, and that's how I ended up here. Yeah? That's that choice that he made at that time. So that choice didn't affect everything that he experienced, right? Now, when he arrived in Perth, right? Coming from Yorkshire, right? So north of England, very cold and grey and all of these things. Arrived in Perth. First thing he did when he got off the boat, he saw people lying on the beach sunbathing. He'd never seen this before, yeah? He thought, wow, that looks good. So the next day he went down and lay on the beach sunbathing all day. That night, he went to hospital. Covered in blisters. He just come from Yorkshire. So then he learned that, and he stayed on in Australia, had a happy and a good life, and, you know, made a reasonable amount of money and had different businesses. He was a He had a logging business and he had a funeral directors and ran different kinds of things. And then, when he was in his 60s, still not that old, he got skin cancer. Yeah? This is a cause and effect, isn't it? Yeah? He came to Australia. If he'd been to Canada, well, he probably wouldn't have ended up with skin cancer. Yeah? And that's what he died of. Yeah? He eventually died of the cancer, which started out as skin cancer. So his choice to come to Australia didn't determine that, but it made it possible. Yeah? So this is like also when we get reborn in a particular state. It's not going to fix everything that happens to us in that state, but it does make certain things possible. It opens up certain kinds of possibilities, and very importantly, it closes down certain other kinds of possibilities. And of course, this is always regarded by the Buddha as being the great benefit of the human realm. It's because in the human realm we have the most ability to reflect on and to make the positive choices and to make the good karma, because we have a mix of good and bad, a mix of happiness and suffering, and because we have good minds and good consciousness, so we can understand things well. So the human realm is always said to be the best realm to be born in if you want to practice Dhamma. If you're born in the heavenly realms, that's okay, you can still practice Dhamma, but most people don't because they're a bit too lazy. It's too much fun, yeah? It's just like being in a resort all the time. So nobody's too serious about their Dhamma practice, yeah? And of course, if you're in the animal realm, then you can still practice a little bit. Yeah, you can still have... I don't know if you've seen the story of the cat in the temple in Korea. Anyone seen that story? Yeah? Goes along to the temple and worships at the shrine every day and sits there. So it's possible, but pretty rare, I think. Yeah, most times animals are not that concerned with Dhamma practice. And if you're in the lower realm, other lower realms of Prayatas and things like that. Actually, if you look in the Buddhist stories, there are some examples of Prayatas or Yakas and things like that who do become converted to Buddhism. But it's quite hard because they've got very strong instincts and very strong kind of desires of greed or hatred or something, so it's fairly rare to be able to overcome them. The human realm's a bit more balanced, believe it or not, right? You might think that it's hard enough in the human realm, but relatively it's a bit easier than it is in other places. So that's just a little bit of background into Buddhist cosmology. Now, while I've got the Digha Nikaya here, I might just read you a little bit, or just point out a little bit here. One of the things to bear in mind when we're thinking about this, we have in the front of this edition of the Digha Nikaya, which you should have a look at, it has the cosmology of Buddhism. Okay, so it has the different realms of devas, the sphere of neither perception nor non-perception, the devas of the sphere of nothingness, and so on, down to the different kinds of Brahma realms, the Tusita devas and Yama devas and so on, the human realm, hungry ghosts, asuras and the hell realms. So there's lists 31 different planes of existence there. Yeah? So this is the conventional list as found traditionally in Theravada Buddhism, and there are similar lists found in the different schools of Buddhism. Now that list as such is not really found in the Buddhist early teachings, although all of those realms are referred to, but the list as a whole is not really found. But what I want to point to, which is perhaps more interesting, is that actually if you look in the suttas and the Buddha's teachings, you find many places where there are all kinds of beings and devas and so on which are mentioned, which don't really fit into that cosmology very easily. Okay, and I'm just going to read here. A few examples here from a sutta called the Maha Samaya Sutta. So this is Digha Nikaya Sutta number 20, and this is just one example where there was a great gathering of the Sangha, and then to celebrate the gathering of the Sangha, many different yakas and devas and all kinds of celestial beings came to attend it, and they they're kind of listed and described here. So this sutta is used very commonly as a paritta, and is used as a protection chant. Yeah? So it's a kind of compilation of the different kinds of divine beings. So here's just kind of one verse here. It says that with the four great kings came their servants who were skilled deceivers all. Okay, so these are some of the deceptive devas: Kutendu, Vetendu, Vitu and Vitucha, Chandana and Kamaseta, Kinugandha, Nigandhu, Panada, Opamanya, Matali, Nala, Chittasena, Raja, Janesabha, Panchasika, Timbaru, Visuryavachasa, his daughter. Okay. Then came Nagas, Kambalas, Asataras, Payagas with their kings, and so on. So I'm just mentioning all of these names. A little further down it has the name of Vasava's brothers, the Kalakanjas, Danavegasas, Vepachiti Suchiti Para Radha, and so on. So most of those names you will never have heard of, right? Yeah. So we've heard of Brahma, we've heard of Saka, we've heard of Indra, we've heard of a few names of different devas. But here we're hearing all of these different names which, frankly, we've never heard of. Many of those are not found in Hindu books. They're not found in the old Vedas. They're not found in later Hindu cosmology and so on. They only appear in lists like that in the Pali Canon. So the point I'm trying to make here is that the cosmology of Buddhism has always been very flexible and very open. Yeah, it, even though you have a kind of a list of these cosmological levels, the reality of the cosmology as it's actually found in the suttas and in the stories and so on is actually a lot more open than that. So, for example, you hear stories, you hear, for example, there's a difference between devas and pretas, yeah? So devas are the good ones and they live happy lives because of good karma and so on, and the pretas, because they made some bad karma, they live... But then there are other stories in the Buddhist canon. There's one that talks about a being who would go along to the temple, a person who would go along to the temple in the daytime and offer dana and keep precepts, but then at nighttime, then they'd go around gambling and drinking and breaking all the precepts, yeah? So they got born as somebody who was a deva in the daytime and a preta at night. Yeah? Yeah? So where's that realm in that list of 31 planes of existence? Yeah, you don't have that kind of half deva, half preta, yeah? So I'm just pointing out that cosmology, it's only an approximation. It's not something we should take too seriously. Actually, what the Buddha said is that all of these beings, all of those different kinds of beings, are all produced by the mind. Yeah? They're all produced by the mind. It's the mind which is the formative force. It's the mind that produces all the different kinds of variations in beings. And even among those beings who we can see, yeah? So for example, in the human realm, hello, is this one working? Okay. Even more so in the animal realm. You see the incredible variety of different kinds of beings, all of them produced by the mind. Yeah? So, I want to consider the implications of that a little bit more. Remember, come back to what I said right at the beginning, that we have these two different ways of seeing them. If you look at, say, like if you think maybe a traditional way of seeing is to say that all of these beings exist objectively, right? That they're kind of out there and they're kind of real entities, like this cup lid is a real entity, okay? So the ghosts and devas are kind of exist out there, right? And the other way, the psychological way of looking at it is to say that they actually exist inside. They're mental projections and mental concepts, right? Which we falsely believe to exist outside. So that's that very dualistic way of looking at things, that things have to either exist objectively out there, or else they're just subjective and they're in here. But that dualistic way of thinking is not Buddhist way of thinking at all. Yeah? The Buddhist way of thinking is to say that the internal and the external are always interrelated, that they're always connected, that what is happening outside is always affecting and conditioning what's happening inside us. And similarly, that what's happening inside us is always affecting and conditioning what's happening externally. Yeah? We think, for example, in the Satipatthana Sutta, and it talks about meditation. It says contemplating the body, one contemplates the body internally. That means contemplating one's own body. It means you say you contemplate externally. That means you contemplate external people's bodies or the earth element or elements externally. And then you contemplate ajahata bahidha, means internally, externally. Yeah? And that means that you see that this body is made just of the four elements, and all of these other bodies are also made just of the four elements. Yeah? So there's actually no real difference between this body and those bodies. This is the Buddhist way of looking at it, is to look at the interrelationship, the interconnection between these things. So it's the same with the existence of gods and devas and all of these things. To think of them as purely existing objectively, externally, is one extreme way of looking at it. To think of that purely just projections of the mind is another extreme way. But actually, from a Buddhist point of view, you say, well, it's probably a bit of both. It's probably a bit of both. Now, how does that work? Okay. Now, have you ever been in the situation? Let's just take a few simple examples to start with. Have you been, where you've been walking along, and this is something that happens if you're living in the forest all the time, you're walking along and you see a stick on the ground and you think it's a snake and you jump up out of fear. Has anyone been in that situation? Yeah, something like that? Some people nodding? I guess maybe if you're living in the city these days it doesn't happen so often. I've been in the situation where I'm walking along the path and I stepped over a stick and it slithered out from under my feet. That's the other way. I have a friend who was in a monastery in northern Thailand. He was coming down from his hut in the morning and walking down the path, and there was a tree had fallen across the path at night time, and he was walking down and stepped across this tree trunk on the path. But as he stepped across the tree trunk slithered out from under his feet, and he realized it was actually a huge snake, not a trunk of a tree. He came down and told the people in the monastery about his experience, and he said, oh, it must have been a huge python that he saw, and he described it and the color and where it was and what time he saw it. And they said, no, it wasn't a python, that was a king cobra. So that's perception, isn't it? Yeah? So perception makes us see things that are not there. Now, we've all imagined monsters in the dark, haven't we? Yeah? And the Buddha even talks about this. One of the suttas, the Bahayabhairava Sutta, the Buddha talks about how when he was practicing before his enlightenment, he'd be sitting there in the middle of the night meditating, and he'd hear a noise in the forest, and immediately he'd jump. Oh, what's that? Yeah. This is what I really love about reading the suttas and reading about the Buddha's accounts of his own practice, because it's very human. Yeah, he wasn't saying, here I was, the world's greatest meditator, and I never have any difficulties. He's saying, oh, I was so scared because I thought there was some animal in the forest. And then he realized, oh, hang on, that was just a peacock, nothing to be worried about. Yeah. So the same thing happens when we're meditating in Australia, yeah, except it turns out to be a wombat or something. Yeah. So, but wombats make quite a bit of noise, yeah. If you're sitting there, and sometimes they come and they rub themselves. Some people staying in caravans or something like that, and they'll come and they'll rub up against the caravan. And if you've never stayed there before and you're not expecting it, it can be pretty scary. Yeah, it starts to shake. The wombats are pretty big. So this is, if you put now you. These days, you guys live in Singapore, right? Any tigers around here? I mean, apart from the beer and stuff. But is there like any real ones? Not in the zoo. Right, in the zoo, exactly. Cages, right? Yeah, so this is what we've done to our monsters. Yeah, we've taken them and we put them in cages. And then they're pretty cute, aren't they? Yeah? it's very sweet. We can go and we see them. Oh, look at the tiger. It's really nice. If he got out of the cage, it'd be a different story, wouldn't it? Yeah? Yeah? So we have a very different relationship with these things than any kind of people in the past. Just something you can read one time is the history of teddy bears. Anyone know about the history of teddy bears? It's a fascinating story because in the West, the bear was always, you know, one of the most ferocious and fearful creatures, yeah? And, of course, in many countries, bears are terrifying, yeah? They're huge and they're very unpredictable. And so it was only towards the end of the 19th, early 20th century that gradually, when the wilderness had been tamed and the people became confident, that they actually began to see bears as cute. And actually, you know, you could have it as a little toy for kids to play with. Before that, it had been like this terrible thing that you had to be afraid of. So as our civilization, as they like to call it, advances, we've tamed the wilderness, yeah? And we've tamed many of those monsters that live outside, yeah? So if you put yourself back into the minds of people who lived in earlier generations, yeah, where you're living in a village, and yes, there are elephants around, there are snakes around, there are tigers around, there are bears around, and these things are all terrifying things, yeah? They're all fearful. So you can imagine that tendency in the mind every time you hear a noise, yeah? Every time you see something shaking in the bushes, then there would be that tendency to amplify it. Everything would become bigger, like in that story of the Buddha. It was only a peacock, but somehow you imagine that it's a big monster. So you can see how people would get this idea that there are monsters everywhere. Yeah? So this is how things come from that internal projection. Yeah? And get amplified. Or another example, this is actually quite an interesting, I'm a bit of a historian, and this is an interesting historical thing that I think most people don't know about, but in India, when they've excavated a lot of the Buddhist monasteries, they found on the sites of the Buddhist monasteries, underneath them were pre-Buddhist sacred sites. Yeah? Of course, this is very common in places around the world, that when there's some kind of temple or place of worship, that different generations will come and build a new one on that site. The same thing in Europe, all churches are built on the site of pagan places of worship. And so underneath is built, there may be some local shrine to a local spirit or something like that. And even underneath that, there may have been shrines or places of animal sacrifice or human sacrifice, which may go back thousands of years. And these are actually on the same sites, but at lower levels than the Buddhist temples. And so on those sites, yeah, what you find sometimes is like these bones of very big animals. And in some places, it depends where you are, but there may be things like animals that don't exist anymore. So things like saber-toothed tigers or woolly mammoths. And these kinds of things. So you find these bones, yeah, of these extraordinary creatures which don't exist anymore. So you can imagine when people found these things, yeah, what would you do if you were digging the foundations for a Buddhist temple and you found, you know, the skull of a saber-toothed tiger underneath there? You know, imagine what you'd think that was, yeah? Of course, you think it's some kind of monster or something like that. So these are some of the sources of these ideas of the monster and so on, which you can see come from ordinary experience, our own amplification of ordinary experience. And the what happens is that our mind, through the process of rebirth, creates worlds and creates realms which in some way reflect our consciousness. As the first line of the Dhammapada says, that mind is the forerunner of all things. Yeah? Mind is a creative force. So all Dhammas are manomaya, are made by mind. And this, again, this is something which is true in a very ordinary sense. We look around us now. Yeah? Everything we see in this room is all made by the mind, isn't it? Yeah? Everything in the ceiling, the walls. Everything here, somebody thought of it. Somebody planned it. Yeah? It was an idea in somebody's mind first, and then later on it took shape. So this is what the Buddha said, is that all these different realms of existence were made by mind, yeah, because of the desires, the concepts, the motivations, the thoughts in your mind is building up this world in the future. Yeah, this is that idea of karma. And if we look inside ourselves, we have demons, yeah, we have angels, we have gods, we have devils, yeah. And that's what they're created from. They're projected onto the world outside. So whereas in the reductionist or the secularist approach would say, all of these things are merely projections of the mind, right? As if projections of the mind are not important. Whereas from a Buddhist point of view, you say, yes, they are exactly projections of the mind, because the projections of the mind is what the world is made up of. The whole world is actually created from projections of the mind. Yeah? So this is why we have to be very careful when we're making karma and the way that we think and the way that we use our mind. The reality is that inside us we have the potential to be in all of these different kinds of realms, and we have been in the past. Okay, so again, according to Buddhism, all of us have been pretas, we've all been hungry ghosts, we've all been yakas, we've all been gods, yeah, we've all burnt in hell, we've all been in the realms that are the most blissful and most wonderful, we've also been in the realms that are most painful, and we may well be so again in the future, yeah, if we don't do something about it now, right? So if you don't realize at least stream entry, at least the first stage of enlightenment, then we don't know what's going to happen to us in the future. Where we go around all of these different realms. Now sometimes when we're looking at this, it's not easy to say whether these things, in any particular case, are these things objectively true or not. Okay? And also it's not all that important necessarily. I'll tell you one story. One time when Ajahn Chah was in his monastery in Thailand, and he was visited by a group of the members of the English Sangha Trust. So when, just as a bit of background, in England in the 1950s, a group of the first generation of Western Buddhists decided to make an organization to support the establishment of the Sangha in England. Actually, one of the members was Maurice Walsh, who did this translation. And they did that, and they were in existence for many years before they eventually invited Ajahn Sumedho to come, and they established the monasteries there. So the members of the English Sangha Trust came to Thailand, northeast Thailand, to meet Ajahn Chah and to discuss with him the founding of the monasteries in England. And the English Sangha Trust were basically quite sort of upper-class, conservative English people, you know, so they're taking a bit of an adventure to go here to the wilds of northeast Thailand and talk to this strange forest monk, you know. But anyway, they did that, and they're sitting there in the shade and having quite an amiable chat with Ajahn Chah through a translator. Ajahn Sumedho was there to translate, and they're drinking tea and so on. And then off in the distance, there was this kind of commotion, this noise. And people were, oh, what's that? And they, it was like this, they heard this screaming, and this woman screaming and yelling. And everyone was like, oh, what's going on? And then they could see off in the distance, a long way away, there was this woman being dragged along, these two guys holding her by her arms, and she was writhing and screaming and kicking. And they were dragging her and bringing her. And so it was this woman who'd been possessed by this devil who was being brought to Ajahn Chah. So as soon as he saw that, Ajahn Chah completely ignored these very important visitors from England and turned around and started barking orders at all the people around. Okay, novices, go and grab some spades, some shovels. Start digging a hole. Okay, you monks over there, grab that firewood, light a fire here. Go to the kitchen, grab the biggest pot that they've got in the kitchen, fill it with water and come and put it on the fire. Light the fire, get it going, bigger and bigger, make it burn more and more. And everyone was running around here and there, and everyone's terrified. And no one knows what Ajahn Chah is going to do, okay? And these poor English people are sitting there thinking, what's this, what's going on? And they're dragging this woman closer and closer. And they're digging furiously, digging this pit in the ground. And Ajahn Chah is yelling at them, dig faster, make it deeper. And then as the woman's coming within earshot, and everyone's so serious, yeah? And Ajahn Chah says, okay, when she gets here, we're going to throw her in the pit and we're going to pour this pot of boiling water over her. That's the only way to get the demon out. And she's coming closer, and as she begins to realize what's happening, she begins to calm down a little bit. And they're bringing her to the pit, and Ajahn Chah's saying, okay, throw her in. And she's saying, oh, I feel quite a lot better now. No, we're not sure that the demon's gone. Throw her in the pit, we'll pour the pot. No, I feel fine, actually. Yeah, no, thanks for that. And so she was fine. So she went back home, and everyone was happy. And so Ajahn Chah turned around and said, oh, sorry for that, and continued his conversation with the English people who were there. So when I'm in Sydney, I'm part of teaching a course on Buddhism and psychotherapy. And so I tell this story to the psychologists in the course. You know, I say, well, there are different approaches to dealing with these psychological issues. You can maybe try this out in your therapy environment and see what happens if you don't get sued or something. Anyway, so, you know, something like that, you know, you can see that happens through the power of Ajahn Chah's charisma. Yeah, you know, it was only because he could carry that absolute authority and had that intuitive understanding of what the right thing to do, and got that kind of result. So many cases are like that. You know, many cases, you know, was there a demon possessing that woman, or was she just having a psychotic fit, or whatever? I don't know. Yeah, I can't really tell from this distance. But it didn't really matter, because somehow, you know, somebody knew how to respond and they managed to fix it. So in the end it was okay. So generally speaking, the Buddhist way of relating to these things is that it essentially is based on good neighborliness. Yeah. So if there are any entities around the place, it's always a good idea to be friendly. Yeah. Doesn't hurt. Put up a little shrine, offer a little bit of rice or whatever at the shrine. Yeah, do a bit of chanting, spread some merit. If there's any local deities in the place or in the trees or in the area, fine, go ahead and do that. And Buddhists have always done that wherever they've gone. And if you look in the different monasteries, you'll always see a little shrine to the local spirits and these kinds of things. And also in the stories, the conversion narratives. One of the kinds of stories which is repeated countless times in the early histories of Buddhism, it always has these stories that, like, when the Buddha or one of the Buddha's disciples went to a new town where they hadn't been before, they would always have problems with the local yakas or local devas. And sometimes the yakas might be very evil, and maybe, like, you'd have these child-eating yakas, you know, who would demand human sacrifice and these kinds of things. And so the Buddha would go in there and would teach the Dhamma, and then they'd be converted and become Buddhists. And so, of course, what you can see is that the story is of how the Buddhist missionaries would convert and would adopt all the local spirit cults and bring them within Buddhism. And so that these yakas or yakinis would end up with a shrine inside the temple. And so people would come along, and they would still make offerings. You wouldn't sacrifice your children to them anymore, but you might offer a bit of rice or, you know, some kind of non-violent offering. And so this is how Buddhists always incorporated these kinds of practices, but would always civilize them, would take away any cruel aspects, anything which is violent or cruel or destructive, they would leave out. but they would bring the gentle aspects of them within the Buddhist practice. And so it's always good to do some metta chanting to spread merits with if there's any deities in the area and so on, and these things are always good. Now, how much can the devas, you know, affect what's going on and so on? It's a bit difficult to say. And generally speaking, to be honest, I don't think the devas are in control. I mean, just take one example that, according to Buddhism, there's often devas living in trees. Yeah, so the Rukha devas who live in the trees. Well, they don't seem to have been able to stop people from chopping all the trees down, do they? Yeah? This is a reality, yeah? We've gone and we've chopped down all the trees. So, well, maybe they're objecting. Maybe they're causing cyclones and floods and things because they don't like the fact that we've chopped down their trees. I don't know, but I think my personal feeling is that most of the time that these kinds of, if there are these kinds of entities and spirits around, they have an influence, but it's a subtle influence. They'll affect like the mood of a place. Yeah, so you know sometimes that it's like that, isn't it? Sometimes you go to a place and it has a certain feeling. Yeah, and these things that you can't really put a finger on. Yeah, sometimes it might feel scary. Yeah, or it might feel very peaceful and calm and uplifting. So I think that the presence of spirits in a place can do these kinds of things, and for this reason I think it's good to do the offerings and to share the merits, and if there are any beings then they know that. But I don't really think that they're capable, in most cases, that they're capable of doing anything much more than that. And I don't think they're very interested in it either. Yeah, I don't think that other beings are particularly interested in humans. And this is another thing you find in the Buddhist scriptures. For example, the devas think that humans are very smelly. You know, if they're going to come and hang around with humans, they sort of have to hold their nose. And yeah, so they only do it if they really have to. Yeah, and they come down maybe for a visit or something like that. But then most of the time they're going to go into their deva realm. Yeah. So isn't that what you'd do if you were a deva? You'd probably hang around in the deva realm most of the time. Yeah. Wouldn't really want to go and hang around with those smelly, obnoxious humans all the time. So, yeah, it's good to make the offerings and to have kindness and respect for other kinds of beings, but not to get too worked up about it. They can't determine your spiritual practice. Remember that the devas would always come to the Buddha for teachings, not the other way around. Yeah? And they wanted to come and listen to the Dhamma and to practice the Dhamma. And this is something which is much more powerful than anything which any deva can give you. So that's my talk for this evening on gods, angels, ghosts, and whatever else it was about. So I offer this for your reflection, and I'd like to invite you to...
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Now we open the questions to the floor. Any questions from any of the members? Anybody have any questions?
Hello. I didn't quite understand this actually in the end, but do Theravada Buddhists believe that there are spirits as an energies?
Yes.
Okay. And if so, do you think that these good energies, spirits, could try to give messages to the human form? And if so, why would they do that?
Could they give messages? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so, yeah. And why would they do it? I think why is a good point. And I think that in most cases they wouldn't want to. And so I think this is why these things are probably somewhat rare. From time to time, they might. Well, for example, I'll give you. There's one of the suttas actually in the Digha Nikaya called the where there's a discussion called the Payasi Sutta. There's a discussion about this, and there's one prince who is a skeptic, and he doesn't believe in rebirth or in spirits and these kinds of things, and he's having a debate with the monk. And he says, "Why don't you believe in spirits and gods?" And he says, "Well, I've done all these tests." See, he was a scientist, right? And he said, "I've done all these tests. For example, I had a friend who was very sick and they were dying, and I told them that, if you're reborn in another realm after you've died, then come back and visit me." Yeah? And they never came back. So that proves it. And then the monk said, "Well, look, that doesn't really prove anything because, well, they might have been reborn in the animal realm. And maybe they were kind of coming and talking to you, but you didn't understand them. Maybe they were reborn in the hell realm, and so, you know, there they are being cooked in hell. So what are they going to do? Ask the waters of hell, please let me out for a little while. I want to go and visit my friend." Or maybe they're born in the Deva realm, and they think, "Oh, I'll just enjoy life here in the Deva realm for a few minutes, and then I'll go and visit my friend." But time passes differently in the Deva realms. So by the time you've done that, as you know, when you're on holiday, yeah. Time passes very differently, and by the time you think of going to visit them, then it's already too late and the person's already died. Yeah? So, again, these stories, they're not necessarily meant to be 100% serious, yeah, with the way that they're presented. They're, you know, there's a certain element of humour to them. But the point, I think, is very true, is that these realms, they are separate realms, and there would have to be an unusual and strong motivation for somebody to make that kind of contact.
Do you think it's possible?
I do think it's possible, yeah. And I think it happens, relatively commonly, yeah. Even though I don't think it's not necessarily all the time, but I do think, in dreams and various psychic events and things like that there is a communication going. And it's true, there are many things that happen where people, you can't really explain what somebody might know except through those kinds of explanations. Yeah. So one story about that is actually a good story is from the biography of Carl Jung, the psychologist. And he had a dream or a vision or something one time, I can't remember which one, it was of his father. And his father died when he was relatively young, and then later on in his life his mother was terminally ill. And then his father came to him in this vision. And, of course, Jung was like, "Wow, it's amazing, it's my dad's come to me from beyond and he wants to ask him about what happens and everything." But his father was not interested to talk to him about what happened in the beyond or anything. The father said to him, I've heard that you've become a great psychologist. You give counseling and advice and help many people with their problems and so on." And Jung said, "Well, yeah, it's true. I've become a psychologist." And he said to him, I know that your mother is very ill and she'll soon be joining me here in the beyond." And Jung was like, "Yes, I know. She's very sad. She's very sick." And the father says, "Well, son, that your mother and I never really got along all that well. And I'm just wondering whether you might have any advice for us that would help." Thing is, we're going to have to spend eternity together. So he's coming for marital advice to the psychologist. So,
just have one last bit to my question. Do you think spirits could attach themselves to human beings as guardian to guide them and to be there, at a certain time in somebody's life to maybe change their destiny? Let's say they're about to get on an aircraft and some phenomena happened, and that could be part of a good spirit energy in a different realm.
It's hard to say. I'm not sure. Many times those kinds of things happen, yeah? And, there's no doubt that those kinds of premonitions and things like that happen quite commonly, yeah? And I've just been reading a book, actually, that's been talking about some of these things. One of the ones that says that the most common one is the telephone telepathy, yeah? Which is where you think of somebody and then they call you, Yeah? Has that ever happened to anybody here? That you're thinking of a person and then when you're thinking of it, then a few minutes later they ring you up? Yeah? Has it ever happened? Or the other way around, you ring somebody up and they say, oh, I was just thinking about you? Yeah, so these kinds of things I think happen quite a lot. So whether it's because of a guardian angel or something like that, it's very hard to say. Yeah. So personally, you know, I would, when I'm considering these things, I would, you know, I'd look at it from an inquiring point of view and really want to say what's actually going on rather than making too many assumptions about it. I'll just give you an example. There was a book I read some time ago called Hungry Ghosts, and it was actually in the library at Bodhinyana Monastery. It's an excellent book. It was about a journalist, a Canadian journalist, who wanted to investigate channeling, right? So there was a group in that area that used to meet once a week, and they used to channel this particular entity. And there's a woman who did the channeling. She was a lab assistant in a chemistry laboratory, a young woman in her 20s. She had no knowledge of what the entity was doing or saying. She would just go into a trance and the entity would speak through her, and she had to ask the people afterwards what had been said and what was going on. And they would meet once a week, and this entity would present through this woman, and they would have to talk and so on. So this journalist joined the group and he wanted to investigate it. And it was very well written, because at the beginning he had this very objective approach. He really wanted to find out, is this true, and so on. But as he went along, he found himself getting more and more caught up in it, more and more believing in what was happening. And he also pulled, when you were reading it, he pulled you into it as well, because he saw you wanted to believe in it as well, yeah? So it was actually quite very clever like that. And these little things would happen along the way that would cause these doubts to arise, yeah? Like, say, one time this entity would maybe be criticizing one of the people in the group, so maybe like having favorites, yeah, they prefer one person than the other or something like that. And so, you know, you found yourself trying to justify it and explain away this behavior, even though you knew it actually wasn't very nice behavior, yeah. And so little things like that would happen. And eventually this journalist decided to continue his test. He went to see another group that was channeling another entity. And he went and sat with that group, and he told this entity, he said, listen, I've been sitting in this group with this other fellow, Joe entity over here. And then the second entity says, oh, no, that one, he's really bad. Yeah, you shouldn't go with that entity. He's really going to lead you down the wrong path. And then he went back to the first one. He said, oh, listen, I was just doing a thing with this. And he said, oh, no, that fellow, he's really bad, yeah. So he's starting to think, what's going on? Yeah, these guys are supposed to be accessing some universal cosmic wisdom, and that they can't even get along with each other. So then he began to have more and more doubts, so he decided to investigate the claims of this entity, and he asked this entity about his previous lives, and the entity had been reborn as a human in two past lives that he got all the details for and investigated them. The immediately preceding past life was as a pilot in the English Air Force during the Second World War. And he got all the details, his name, the squadron he was in, all the people who were in the squadron, where they flew, what they flew, all of the details, everything, so many details. And then he went to England and checked it all out and met the people in the previous squadron, talked to them, and everything was absolutely true, including little incidental details that were not written down in any history or found in any book or anything like that. And he was able to confirm all of the points by talking with the people who were still alive from the squadron. So, of course, it was very convincing. The other past life was in Greece, the generation before that, so around the time of the First World War, or the beginning of the 20th century. And it was sort of on the northeastern corner of Greece. And he went there, and again he had all the details, the places, the names, the events, and so on. And nothing was right. Nothing matched up. Yeah, the language that was spoken wasn't the same language that he was supposed to be. You know, the towns weren't there. Nothing was there. It was just a fiction. Yeah. So that's very interesting, isn't it? Yeah. So the conclusion that he came to after that was that, you know, there is something going on, But that these beings, these entities, actually were feeding off the adulation and the praise which the people were giving them. Yeah? That's why he called it hungry goats. They're actually hungry for the praise and the worship. And that, yes, there are some things they can say which are quite remarkable and quite true, but that doesn't mean that they're perfect. It doesn't mean that, that you can trust everything that they say. Yeah, so that, that book was really worth reading. Okay, next question. Oh, here we have some written down. Right. What happens when babies died in Japan earthquake? Is that right? What happens when babies died in Japan's earthquake? Are their lives shortened? I'm not quite sure what that's mean. Of course their lives shortened when you die. I don't know if the asker of the question is, I'm not quite sure what that question's getting at. Anyone game to speak up about the question or explain it some more? Sorry, I'm just not quite sure what you're looking for with the answer. No? Someone's too shy to speak up. So if you want to write it down again and let me know, then but I'm just not quite sure what you're after, so sorry about that. If we have the imagination of the devil. Oh, okay, so if we have, this one is about if in our mind, if we have this like imagining we feel the devil or some kind of very dark entity in our mind, how do we get rid of it? What do we do? And even if in dreams and things like that, if these things keep on coming back to us. So this is a very good question, because sometimes these things happen. Yeah. Now, in every one of us, yeah, until we're enlightened, we have greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah? What we call a devil or a demon is merely a being which has allowed their minds to be overrun with these forces of greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay, that's all. Nothing more, nothing less. So, since we have those forces of greed, hatred, and delusion in ourselves, we have those seeds of creating those demons within us. The same forces are there within us that are within all of those demons. Yeah? So if we find those images, this is what I was saying before about that you can't reduce it to either a purely psychology, it's just inside, or it's purely an external. But it's the same forces which are present in the demons, which are present in ourselves. And so it's very hard to know, if you're having these visions, is this some kind of entity outside which is coming to visit me, or is this my own projection? Yeah? And the reason it's hard to know is because essentially it's the same. Essentially it's just manifestations of greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's not really that different in the end. And in either case, the solution to it, what we do, is to get rid of greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah, this is the cause of the problem. The actual entity or the demon is like it's a manifestation. It's a personalization of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's our own defilements which is given some kind of concrete form, and that's what we call these demons and so on. So what we need to do is to look into our heart to overcome greed, hatred, and delusion, and to see what particular form that entity has. Now, for example, if that entity is very violent and very aggressive, then we overcome that by doing loving kindness. Yeah? And it doesn't matter too much if that entity comes from outside or if it comes from within, or both, actually. Actually, what can easily happen is, because we have the forces within us, then this is what attracts or allows the other entity to come as well. Yeah? So sometimes it can be a bit of both, external and internal. But in any case, what we can do is we can let go of the greed, hatred, and delusion. We can develop the loving kindness and overcome the anger, which is really fueling this kind of this demon. If there are cases, and I'm going to say this because I know that this does happen to some people, but if there are cases where these entities are manifesting in a way that's very scary and very disturbing, yeah, to people, then it's good to seek some help for it. Okay, so don't be alone. That's one thing I say to you. Yeah, you know, you can come along to the temple or the Buddhist fellowship or somewhere and ask to talk to somebody about it, or you can find a psychologist or therapist of some kind who's going to be sympathetic, someone who's a Buddhist who will understand these things, or maybe a friend or relative or a Dhamma teacher or somebody. Find somebody to talk to about it. Don't be alone. Okay, these things are not it's not unique. You're not if these things are happening to you, you're not the first person it's happening to. So find someone to talk to about it, and maybe you need some help and some support to help you get through if it's a difficult time. Okay, any more questions?
Last question before we close the session. Anybody?
Venerable Sujato, just ask a question regarding the Singapore context on the Ghost Festival. Yes. On the particular month, we celebrate in Chinese, especially in Singapore, we have this Ghost Festival, and in some of the Buddhist temples as well. So I think they have this misconception whereby on that particular month, there are more ghosts, you know, they must be released from the hell, realm. And, you know, maybe other days are not so much ghosts. So what do you comment, what do you, can enlighten us on the Buddhist context on this, ghost realm on that particular month?
What month did they do that in?
We do it in the middle, the July, the Chinese calendar.
This is 7th month. Okay, yeah, 7th lunar month. I think they have the same festival in Thailand, yeah? It's about the same time. They usually do that. And also in Vietnam, I believe, they have a similar festival, probably all originally stems from the same one, yeah? But it's not dissimilar to what the origins of Halloween in the West was, yeah? Halloween's basically the same thing. It's all, literally, that's where it'll be. It's All Hallows Eve is when the spirits get released from hell and so on. So opening up the gates of hell, freeing all the beings, letting them wander around for a while, and then, I don't know, are they supposed to just voluntarily go back? when you start to think about the details of this, it starts to get a little bit less plausible, doesn't it? Yeah. But I think one of the origins of this, I mean, I wouldn't take those things too literally, but I think the origin of it is that there should be a time for acknowledging of these things. One of the, how am I going to put this? A lot of our thoughts and ideas about entities and spirits and so on is all conditioned by our fear of death. Yeah, we don't want to die, and we somehow want to continue in some form after we've died, most of us. But we're also at the same time kind of afraid of death. Yeah, we're afraid of dead bodies and people who have died and so on. We don't like to, hang around cemeteries in the middle of the night and these kinds of things. So we have these sort of combinations of kind of longing and fear. We're afraid of ghosts and things, but at the same time we kind of yearn for some contact with beloved ones who maybe have passed away. So there's this kind of mixture of feelings that we have around all of these kinds of things. And so a lot of our ideas about these spirits and entities and so on are all conditioned by these emotional needs that we have. So one of the ways that we, as a culture, that we deal with that, and one of the ways that human society deals with these kinds of problematic situations is that you kind of allow it for a certain period of time, and then you can close it up after that time. Yeah? So you say, well, there's this period where these spirits are out and they're roaming free and all of these things, and then it's okay at the end of it. Do you see what I mean? So, and this is very, very common. If you look anthropologically all around the world, many, many different societies have this same kind of idea in one way or another. The way they do it is different, but many places they have this. And so you'll have some kind of day, some period, where the spirits in some way are closer, where the walls between worlds become thinner, and the contact between ourselves and the departed becomes more possible. Yeah? And then that's allowed for a period of time, and then it finishes, and we can go back to our ordinary life. Yeah? And so this is one of the ways that human societies have developed that helps us to cope with those stresses, the fear of death, the fear of ghosts, and all of these kinds of things. So in that way, I think that it's culturally a healthy thing to do. Whether or not there are actually more ghosts around in that kind of period of time, well, maybe there are. I don't know.
There's a sadhu three times.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.